Welcome to the New Urban Architect Podcast, a collection of interviews with design professionals about the role of architecture within new urbanism.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Brant Hay. Our guest today is architect Steve Muzan. Steve is principal of the Miami-based firm Muzan Design, founder of the New Urban Guild, and author of numerous architectural plan books and pattern books. He has a very active social media presence as well, and you can interact with him online via Twitter and his blog, Original Green. Steve, it's great to have you on the line with us today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Before we get too far along, do you mind telling us a bit about yourself?
Well, you know, it's people ask me all the time, well, what do you do? And it sounds like an old spy movie because I tell them, well, if I told you, you wouldn't know what I mean. I don't say if I told you, I'd have to kill you, but, similar sort of lead-in. But basically what it amounts to is this. My model for years has been, almost a decade now, has been to find needs that aren't being met and try to fill them. And so basically the most of the stuff that I do is stuff that I'm making up as I go along. And so it's resulted something you've never heard of before. It isn't just normal architectural services. There's plenty of architects out there to do that. So what I try to do is I try to say, well, what are the gaps? And so if I tell you that I write living tradition pattern books, you might say, well, you know, I know what a pattern book is, but what's a living tradition pattern book? Or if I talk about offering a circuit rider town architect services, you might say, well, I've heard of a town architect, but what in the world is a circuit rider? And it goes right down the list because basically there's very little that I do right now is what you would consider normal. Most of it nearly all of it actually is this other stuff. And so it makes for an interesting time to do this sort of thing that is sort of invented as it goes along.
Well, it sounds like you've really done a great job identifying unfulfilled needs in the market and figuring out a way to tailor your services to fill in those gaps.
Yes, it is kind of funny because on the one side of the equation, these things that I'm inventing, it makes me the best on earth. It also makes me the worst on earth because I'm the only one doing them, so it depends on how you want to spin it it makes a funny story at least.
Well, Steve, looking back a few years, I remember the first time I ever heard you speak publicly, and you were talking about something you said you just recently discovered, one of these inventions you mentioned, and it went something like this: we do this because. Does that ring a bell?
Absolutely. I suspect that years later, if anybody, it may be that none of us are remembered for anything anyway, but if I'm ever remembered for anything, I think it might be that particular epiphany, because it changed so much about what I do and what everyone else can do too. And basically, here's the idea. Day after Thanksgiving 1980, my wife and my sister and her boyfriend at the time and I we'd had too much to eat the day before, too much turkey, and we said, well, let's go walk. Well, the place I grew up was totally unwalkable, and so there was a little planter's hamlet about 20 miles away. It's called Mooresville, Alabama, and so we said, well, let's go to Mooresville and walk, and it was a tiny little hamlet, only 3 blocks by 3 blocks. It's 9 square blocks, and that's all there was to it. And yet, I was in architecture school at the time, and of course our professors had told us we're going to be the greatest generation of architects. You know, we have computers, and our builders have bigger power tools, and the mortgage companies have more clever mortgages. And of course, we all know how that ended. Because their presumption was because our tools were better, we were going to be better. And yet, here I was in a place built beginning in 1818 by a bunch of simple farmers and tradespeople that had no computers, no internet, no power tools, no mortgages even, and yet they had built a better place than anybody had since World War II, even of all the greatest architects. Now, the architects had built better buildings, but not a better place. And so my question was, how can this be? You know, how can you have a bunch of people that are completely uneducated and do better than the experts can now. And, you know, you can sort of understand once someone starts doing something, once, you know, the people of a town, they start doing things in a certain way, how they can keep doing it. But the real question is, when you have a wisdom so great that it allows the completely uneducated people, some of which may even be illiterate for that matter, to do better than the experts today, how do they take that that wisdom and pass it down to the next generation? How do they transmit the wisdom, if you will? And so, to me, that was a huge mystery. I mean, I simply couldn't understand it at all. And I called for years. I called it I called it the transmission device of the vernacular mechanism. And when I'd say that, people's eyes would glaze over, and they would say, "What in the world are you talking about?" You know. But then later on, I've started calling it the transmission device of living traditions, and at least living traditions, they can kind of imagine what that might be, as opposed to the vernacular mechanism, what in the world is that, you know? But it was always a great mystery. But the one thing I did is I adopted the mystery, as opposed to just saying, "Well, I don't understand that," and let it go. Then nothing comes of that. But there, one thing that, now, first of all, let me say this: I'm no Einstein, but one thing that Einstein said years ago that I've always appreciated is he said, "You know, I'm not that much smarter than anybody else. The difference is that I simply stick with the problem longer." And I thought, well, you know, I can do that. You know, there's nothing about brilliance that keeps you from adopting a mystery. So I adopted that mystery, and for over 20 years, I was trying to figure out what the answer was. You know, and for a long time, I thought it would be, you know, something kind of mystical, like you know, the connection of the original Americans to the land or something like that, that post-industrial people just couldn't understand. But what we realized later on, first of all, I believe that the transmission device, the mystery of the transmission device, has now been unlocked, I believe. And it happened, actually it was at the end of the Lost Rabbit charrette by the New Urban Guild several years ago in Jackson, Mississippi. We were all back at the B&B where we were staying, and we're just talking in general. It was after dinner, and someone asked Milton Grenfell, they said, "Well, why is it that you have these?" We've been talking about the bell cast eaves, you know, where the roof is steeper and then it gets shallow right at the edge. You know, why do you have these in this area? And he said, "Well, we do this because that we need the relatively steep roofs, but not too steep, for hurricane wind resistance. You know, if it's too shallow, then it fails in uplift. Of course, if it's too steep, it fails in overturning. So 8 and 12 to 9 and 12 is about the right slope." And he said, "But if you have a torrential rain and the water is coming off at that steep of an angle, it'll totally obliterate the landscaping. So what we do is we kick it out at the edge so that when the water hits that, then it first of all diffuses the force, and then it also disperses it into a more of a spray than a steady stream coming off." And it didn't hit me immediately. It took several minutes for it to sink in what he had said. But basically, he prefaced the whole thing about the description of why the architecture was that way with "we do this because." And then all of a sudden it did hit me. I said, "Wait, that's the answer. That's what I've been searching for all these years, that if you can take each pattern in a language of architecture and put it into those terms where it isn't just, thou shalt do this because I have better taste than you." You know, people will, they'll comply with that to get a building permit, but nobody actually likes that. You won't ever restart a living tradition by saying something like that, you know. But if you say, on the other hand, "we do this because," then what that does is that opens up the rationale for the architecture to everyone, for them to understand it again. You know, as opposed to it being just the kind of the few, the proud, the architects, if you will, you know, it's been an enormous unlocking of ideas that followed that. In other words, what I mean by this is that For example, I was able to take that one, well, those four words, that one snippet of information, and understanding that, was able to completely reinvent architectural pattern books along those lines. And then also there's all sorts of other implications. For example, if there is a reason, then suddenly that means that the random collection of historical styles that we have up until now done in every pattern book, you know, we didn't know how to do any better. I can remember years ago, I was on a panel at the CNU with Ray Gendros, he had invited me, and several other people were on the panel talking about pattern books. And the one big thing that I said, you know, we have no idea right now how to use a pattern book, or even if a pattern book can be used to allow architecture to live again, you know, because architecture has always evolved from the dawn of time until really the beginning of the 20th century, at which we began to have a series of little modernist revolutions rather than evolution. But it's always evolved and lived, you know, throughout almost all of human history up until now. But the pattern book will not allow that to happen, the conventional style-based pattern book, because here's what happens. If you do a book and you've got, you know, you've got bungalows and you've got Greek Revival, you've got Federal, you've got, you know, Carpenter Gothic or whatever, you know, or Deco, name a style, doesn't matter. Because of the fact that, well, you know how when occasionally when something gets named after someone in their living person, then they can occasionally disgrace themselves. There was a doctor in my home state of Alabama that had done all sorts of wonderful stuff, and they were naming boulevards after him and buildings and all this kind of stuff all over the region. And then come to find out he was in some kind of a scam thing and disgraced himself, and then they had to go and take his name off all this stuff. And a lot of people have policies that we won't name anything after someone alive for that very reason. And so, but what happens is all of these, all of the historical styles are now dead. They have, just like a tombstone, they have a beginning date and an ending date. And so therefore, because they are fixed in time and they have no life really, then you can count on the fact that they won't change. Now the downside of that is the fact that if you have a pattern book of historical styles and you say, well, here we're going to build according to this, what that means is that even 50 years in the future, if some of the lots in the place aren't sold yet and somebody goes to build at that point in time, then the architecture that they will create as a result of the pattern book will be exactly like the architecture today, and so it has no life, because something that has no change has no life. You know, it's kind of like a child. When a child is born, you know, you do the best you can to try to know how to raise the child to know, you know, how to do the right things and all this. But you actually don't know what they're going to do, because they are a living thing and they can take their own way, and they do take their own way, and so it becomes a big mystery. But with historical styles, it is no mystery. So my contention is we've got to be able to, if we want to really rejoin the ranks of purveyors of living architecture, as opposed to just, you might say, statue makers. You know, you can make a statue to someone who was patterned after someone who was once alive and is now dead, or could be still alive for that matter. But the statue itself has no life, because it doesn't change. And so if we want to go from being a statue maker to actually to making living things again, then we've got to get beyond this thing of the historical styles and say, you know, how do you actually make an architecture that can change and can evolve over time? And that's actually what We Do This Because actually does. Because when you preface every pattern by that, then that gives everyone from the grandest architect to the to the most commonplace townsperson, you know, the right to actually think about that pattern. Well, if that's why we do that, then how about this? you know, how about that, or how about the other? And those may be things that, we as architecture regulators or town architects or whatever have never thought of, and, you know, wouldn't have even occurred to us, because when you empower millions of minds to think as opposed to just a few of us, then you have no idea, just like the child growing up, you have no idea really exactly where it's going to go. You just know it's guided by those same principles. And so it's been enormously helpful in that way. Here's another thing, too. When you say, well, there is a reason, then you can't say that about a bunch of random historical styles that were developed in different places. And, you know, because if you have a reason for, you know, the reason for doing a porch according to one of the accepted bungalow porch patterns is simply because, well, that's the way you do bungalows. And, but that's not... you know, everybody except an architectural historian, their eyes glaze over when he's on that. But if it's a reason that is based on the regional conditions and climate and culture, you know, of a region, another way of saying that, if it's based on this people and on this place, then all of a sudden it becomes meaningful. It brings the architecture to us as opposed to it being just something that someone somewhere else developed. You know, at some other point in time. And, so what happens then when you say, well, there is a best architecture of here and of us, then when you do that, you know, then all of a sudden that you have this enormously powerful tool to go to the builders, to their framers, to the trim carpenters, to the masons, to the, you know, all of the craftspeople, and to say, well, look, here's the reasons why that we do an eave this particular way. You know, it may be if it's more, you know, and you introduce to them the, classical vernacular spectrum, and I introduce that to a bunch of craft apprentices in New Orleans working for the Prince's Foundation last fall, and they very instantly adopted that, except in their own terms. So they, said, oh, classical, you mean fancy pants. and vernacular, you mean plain Jane. So yeah, that's what I mean. That's exactly what I mean. And then they instantly had a frame of reference for understanding what we were talking about. You know, they made it theirs. They made the idea theirs. And then also the other axis to the matrix is architecture from urban to rural. In other words, on Main Street, if you built a barn on Main Street, it would look ridiculous. Versus if you built a Main Street shop out in the middle of the country, it would look ridiculous also. And so, you know, you do. It's either from classical to vernacular or urban to rural that the architecture can adjust. But it nonetheless is the architecture of here and of us. And so, when you do that, then you can do all sorts of things that empowers the builders and their tradespeople to actually get involved and make decisions, because really the ideal is a scenario where the townspeople build the town again. And, you know, nobody in the right mind will make the case that in countless little Italian hill towns or little villages in the Cotswolds or anything like that, that you had the Imagineers come in and plan all this out. No, of course not. It's something that the townspeople simply built the town, and without architects in most cases. As a matter of fact, Mooresville, Alabama, that I was telling you about, it was at least 40 years after the founding of Mooresville that the first architect ever even set foot in the town. You know, there'd not even been an architect in town until 40 years later. And so, you know, then you have to say, well, you know, this was a different mechanism, and sure enough it was. And so, but anyhow, it's the whole idea of we did this because has opened up all sorts of possibilities for actually making architecture live again and creating this thing that I call a living tradition, which is really key to sustainability. But I guess that's long enough on that riff. What else is on your mind?
I just wanted to mention that I find this way of looking at things very inspiring. What you've really done here is you've turned your back on the use of coercion, and you've decided to pursue the empowerment that comes with persuasion. In many ways, it reminds me of what happens when something goes viral on the web. You know, someone posts some sort of content, whether it's audio, video, pictures, whatever, and it's so compelling that thousands of people see it, and they share it with everybody they know, not because someone told them to, not because they feel like they have to, just because they like it so much and they want to share the ideas with other people. And in many ways, it seems like your concept of living traditions really unlocks this potential within the world of architecture.
Well, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because actually a living tradition is a particular type of idea virus. You know, some idea viruses, when something goes viral, it can go all over the internet and have millions of hits in 36, 48 hours or something like that sometimes. Those are very vigorous strains. But a living tradition is an idea virus that number one spreads all over, but it is very lasting. It can last for decades or centuries or occasionally even millennia. And so it's something that in many ways the living tradition is the highest form of the idea virus because it is so long lasting.
As we both know, there's a whole lot of talk about building green these days. And the talk is usually centered around the idea of gizmos, solar power, all that sort of thing. But do you think it'd be fair to say that there is nothing greener you could do in the design of a building than to design it in a way such that it would last a long time, so that it would still be in use 100, 200, even 300 years from now?
Well, absolutely, and here's why. And that is because, well, there's another mechanic here, another mechanism, I should say, going on. And let me explain that. And that is that today we have literally millions of people around the world that are working to figure out how do we live sustainably today. So it's a big problem. It's millions of the best minds, and we haven't figured it out yet, and they've been working on it for years. Now, I'm an optimist, so I believe that we eventually will figure it out. But then when we do, you know, that's obviously very high-level knowledge. But the problem is we cannot achieve sustainability by simply something that someone else is going to do for us. In other words, we'll never become green by going shopping for more efficient equipment, because more efficient equipment simply makes our tremendously wasteful modern lifestyle just simply a little bit less wasteful, that's all. But it's still wasteful. And so what we've got to do is we've got to be able to take this high-level wisdom and we've got to be able to spread it very broadly. Well, that normally doesn't happen. You know, if you take higher education, for example, and count the number of PhDs in any given room, and you'll see it's always a very small part of the population. If you take public education, which is very broad, you know, if you don't go to school, the truant officer will come after you. But you'll see that people don't solve, they don't find a cure for cancer with just K-12. I mean, it just doesn't work that way. And so this is a very peculiar problem. But if you think about it, the highest wisdom that we have ever encountered in the natural world is the wisdom of the human genome. It took scientists decades just to decode the thing. I mean, I think they started work on that back in the 70s maybe or something like that, and they just recently finished it. And it'll be easily 100 years before we really even begin to have a substantial knowledge of what all that decoding means. So that's the highest wisdom of all that we have uncovered in the natural world or ever likely to uncover is the way it looks now. However, if you think about it, there's 6 billion people alive today, on the way to 9 billion in our lifetimes probably, if we live a normal lifetime. Almost none of those are genetics engineers. So how did we get this many people? Well, obviously, what happened is it's something that occurred not because they're all genetics engineers, but simply with no education in most cases and on-the-job training, you might say. And, of course, we all know how that works. It happens when, one person is attracted to another person, and they mate and they breed, not necessarily in that order, and they pass on their genetic material, you know. But it doesn't work because they know genetics. They only have to have a passing knowledge of, if I do this, we may have kids, you know. And they don't even necessarily have to even know that. But it begins by the attraction I got married because at the very beginning I said, wow, she's really hot. I mean, she's really beautiful. So 31 years later, here we are still. But the point is, what nature has done is to embed great wisdom in beauty. And so all you need to do is be attracted to the person, and then all that great wisdom passes along without really even needing to know much about it. Now, we can that's the mechanism that we can use, the mechanism of the living tradition, actually works in much the same way, where if we can take something that is highly sustainable, and if somebody has to know all the details of sustainability, you know, they'll never do it. You know, and in most cases, when people are talking about sustainability, you kind of feel like, well, gee, I need a PhD to even be a part of the conversation, you know, because it's such high-level stuff. And but what happens is if we can take the wisdom of sustainability, embed that into stuff that people consider beautiful, that where they say, I want one of those. I want a home like that. I want a shop like that. I want a town like that, according to what the scale of it is. Then sustainability can be passed on without people having to have PhDs to understand it. And so that is really the key. Once I came across that realization a few years ago, then it became pretty obvious that without a living tradition, we don't have any way of spreading sustainability. Nothing else that we've ever produced other than living tradition as a human construct has the ability to spread very high-level wisdom very broadly. There is no other way that we know of doing it. And then the living tradition is something that has been proven literally for centuries and even for millennia to actually be able to spread ideas. And so it's not just that it would be good to be green by doing this, but this is the only proven way that we have of knowing how to be green, and there are not even any other contenders. It's not like there's other mechanisms out there that might work. You know, we have no clue what might work if we don't embed this wisdom in a living tradition. So it's really a lot more important than what I first realized, you know, years ago when I started working on these ideas.
You often use the term lovable in reference to architecture. How would you say the idea of lovability fits into the whole process of building green?
Well, there's really, in terms of buildings, there's really four things that makes a building green. But it begins with lovability. Lovability is the very first thing, because if a building cannot be loved, it will not last. And it doesn't matter what the carbon footprint is. Once you cart the pieces off to the landfill, the carbon footprint of a building is utterly meaningless. So it must be loved. But the next thing it must be, is it must be durable after it's lovable. Because if it doesn't endure, it won't last either. And, you know, so many of the things that we're building today are literally, I mean, there are subdivisions out there that are 10 years old, and you can drive around and you will see stuff that is literally falling off in the driveway. I mean, building parts, you know. And so we're building the least durable stuff today. I have just a big rant that I'll go off on occasionally. I won't bother you with it here today. But basically, in a nutshell, it is this idea of no-maintenance materials. Because basically, if you plan to bulldoze the building in 15 years, then yes, it's no-maintenance. However, if you don't plan, if you want it to last for a long time, then the no-maintenance stuff, literally, when it fails catastrophically. And so, like I say, that's a whole other discussion unto itself. But it must endure. And then after it endures, if it's lovable and durable, then it must be flexible. Because let's say a building lasts 1,000 years. You know, our ancestors used to build buildings like that. You can go to all sorts of towns in Europe and see buildings at least 1,000 years old, some that are 2,000. But if a building lasts that long, then chances are, over the course of its life, it will be used for countless things that we can't even anticipate today. You know, if you think of all the things that these old buildings have been used for, those uses didn't even exist in most cases when the building was built. And so what it amounts to is that the program is one of the most overrated things in architecture. And instead of worrying about building a good daycare center or a good restaurant or a good whatever, we should simply be worrying about building a good building that is flexible so it can be used for many things. And finally, if it's lovable and durable and flexible, then the building needs to be frugal, because if it's a lovable, durable, flexible energy hog, then that's a terrible thing because nobody will let you tear it down. And it's hard to tear down too. And so it needs to be all of those things. And then part of frugality, I really need to mention this, part of frugality is encapsulated with inside of an idea today that I call Gizmo Green. Now, Gizmo Green is the idea that with better gizmos or better machines and better materials, that we can achieve sustainability. Well, now, better equipment and better materials are a part of the solution, but they're only a very small part of it. They're only a fraction of frugality. And frugality is only one-fourth of green buildings or sustainable buildings. And sustainable buildings are in themselves only half of the equation, because the other half is that we must be, first of all, building sustainable places so that it's even meaningful to talk about sustainable buildings, because if the place isn't sustainable, you know, it doesn't matter if the building has a carbon footprint of zero. If you have to drive everywhere to inhabit the building, then that's not good either. And so the point is that Gizmo Green is something that's almost the entire discussion. As a matter of fact, I was at the AIA convention, national convention here in Miami yesterday, and I'm about to go back today. And all of the green building discussions that I've been in so far, it's all about Gizmo Green. That's all that you hear is better equipment and better materials. But that really is such a tiny part of real sustainability that's a big part of this, of the mission of the Original Green, this Original Green initiative that I have, is to try to open people's eyes to the idea that it's a whole lot more than just Gizmo Green. Better gizmos are good, no question about it, but they're not the be-all and the end-all.
Before you sign off, I wanted to mention one more thing. Rumor has it you have a new book out. Is that right?
Yes. As a matter of fact, it's just come out. It's called The Original Green. The subtitle is Unlocking the Mystery of True Sustainability. The foreword, for whatever it's worth, was by Bobby Kennedy Jr., who, incidentally, his wife Mary came to the very first Original Green seminar in New York years ago. And their house was flooded and infested with mold and mildew, and their family was sick all the time. And they tried all sorts of solutions, and none worked. And so they recently have rebuilt the house as a last resort. And everything that they did in the house, they did according to Original Green principles. Now, they have the gizmos also, which, again, as I say, are part of the solution, but not the whole thing. But the house is lovable and durable and flexible, and it's also naturally frugal in so many ways. And so I'm delighted that they did that, and also thanks to Bobby for writing the foreword.
So I'm wondering, have you lined up a rock star book tour along with a cover shoot for Architectural Record magazine?
Yes, and probably not are the two answers. Yes, we are planning the book tour right now. As a matter of fact, if you hear of anyone that has any interest in having me come to your city or town, then let me know, and I'd be delighted to see what we can do to get them on the tour, because it will go through the summer and really through the fall. I've got some events lined up already in October, and several more that we're about to schedule. Really looking forward to it. And like I say, if you know someone, let me know.
Well, Steve, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Delighted. Anytime, let me know, and I'd be happy to fill in again. That would be great.
Thanks for listening to the New Urban Architect Podcast, produced by W. Brant Hay Architect. Check us out on the web at newurbanarchitect.com.